Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
A very special podcast coming at you from at least 6 feet away, but probably more.
From across town. What antiques were we talking about this week?
We're going to talk a little bit about tin toys.
Tin toys.
Often referred to as chromolithograph tin toys. That's actually a very specific tin toy. I'll get into that.
Often referred to with that?
Often. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, in the biz.
Just for people who want to flex with pronunciation?
It's not that difficult to say chromolithograph.
Sure.
It's only like 17 syllables. But yeah, tin toys, it's, I think, one of the more popular and maybe more mainstream of the collectibles you can get into.
I wouldn't know mainstream if it bit me on the ass, my dude.
To be fair, neither would I. I'm, like, when I say mainstream, it's like, yeah, I know a lot of people who do that and then completely forget that, like, I'm not mainstream.
You forget that we know a very specialized subset of the general population.
Yeah, exactly. So, a tin toy is a toy made from tin. The end. All right, the podcast is over. Shut it down.
Groundbreaking.
So, tin is actually a misnomer. It's actually made from tin plate. And tin plate is a substance made of thin sheets of steel that's coated on either side with tin.
What?
Yeah.
Everything I know is a lie.
Well, it makes sense when you think about the fact that tin on its own is incredibly malleable and soft.
Okay.
So, you know, for them to actually stay rigid, there would have to be thin sheets of pressed steel.
But then why paint tin over it?
You know, reasons. The tin was actually mostly to pad out. To do it with just steel would have been expensive. But if you go half steel, half tin, it's not so pricey.
Okay.
It keeps the cost down and the manufacture fast. Because they do need to be a little malleable because of the way they tend to be put together. These would be painted and then later chromolithographed to resemble people, places, and things.
And chromolithography is a printing process?
It is a printing process, yes.
Ha.
So this came around 1815, which is when we got the technology, or I guess Britain did, for sheet metal stamping, which is basically like the introduction to basic mass production. So now that you could just, like, stamp out thin sheets of metal, you could just make stuff from it, and boy howdy did they ever, including toys. Before that, toys were generally painstakingly handmade and made either from, like, pig metal or cast iron pretty frequently or wood. And these all had drawbacks. When you combine this with the fact that right about now we see an incredibly slow changing attitude towards children in childhood, you can kind of see that this is going to pop off. In about, I don't know, like, what is it going to be, like, 100 years before kids, like, get paid for working in the mines?
What year are we on?
We're in 1815.
Okay, yeah, it's going to be a while before they stop letting 10-year-olds into mine shafts.
Yeah, yeah, but, you know, things are starting a little bit, kind of.
Kind of. Infanticide is about to become a crime.
Just give it 100 years, we'll get there. around 1850, the ability to sheet metal stamp gives you cheaply produced spring-activated clockwork-type toys.
Oh.
And the 1880s see the invention of offset lithography and offset chromolithography, which was a new and revolutionary way to print things onto other things.
I see.
It was much faster and less laborious than other printing processes, which tended to be individual plates. So now, tin toys are light, and they're attractive, and they're durable, and they're light. Did I mention that they're light? Because the main thing that this is going to pop off is that now you can ship them pretty cheap.
Because they're light as a feather and stiff as a board?
Yep. They are both those things. They are witchcraft. You have got it. You got to the heart of it. I have a whole paragraph I don't have to say now.
I've solved it. You're welcome.
So with cast iron being one of the main components in, like, a lot of toys, you can imagine that they don't get exported very often.
Oh, but now they can, because lightweight.
But now they can, and they do. Germany, being the absolute titan of manufacture that it was up until, we know, they take over pretty much being the kings of tin toys. This also doesn't hurt that they had established tin mines, which the U.S. wouldn't get until, I think, 1890.
Oh, wow.
And so they were set up to absolutely dominate, and the fact that now they can more easily export toys, toy companies cropping up all over Germany. Most famously, Ernst Paul Lehmann of Lehmann Toys. We're not going to talk about him. I just felt like it was important to mention it because he's like the grandfather of tin toys.
Okay.
And when I say a lot of German toy companies, I do mean a lot.
At least four.
Germany was followed by France and England. So tin toys, also called in general penny toys, because they were, again, extremely cheap, mostly manufactured and exported to the U.S. until... remember that thing I said about Germany and what stopped it from being a juggernaut of industry?
The Great War.
The Great War obliterates everyone's willingness to buy anything from the Germans, and most other countries are too devastated to worry about making toys. Except the U.S. U.S. not having fought on its own soil, they were in a great position to make toys.
Yeah.
And make they do. They pretty much take over the empty slot in the industry with a vengeance, particularly Louis Marx, the golden god of vintage toys. I think everyone, even if you're not very into antiques, has, like, could refer to Marx toys as like, ah, yeah, I don't feel a veil of confusion sweep over me at that word.
I know, man.
No?
A veil of confusion has perpetually appeared upon my brow upon each morn as I wake.
Well, anyway, That's sad. You also get other names that you might remember, like Parker Brothers.
I know them. They make genuine talk boards.
They make the only genuine talk boards. Milton Bradley and some now defunct companies like Corgi, Dinky, etc., etc. Most of those are actually rolled into like other bigger toy companies, but nobody knows their names and most people know Corgi, so.
Hasbro, Hasbro, and more Hasbro?
Yeah. Well, Hasbro's later. I don't think Hasbro is until... I actually have a list here. Hold on. Yeah, Hasbro's not until 1923.
Oh, I thought you meant the companies now were absorbed into.
Oh, no!
Because, like, Parker Brothers definitely got bought out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because right now I am drinking out of a genuine Hasbro Ouija mug.
No, Mattel got, actually, I think, the lion's share of a lot of the old companies. Yeah, Mattel got Fisher-Price.
Oh, wow.
I think Mattel got Dinky.
Go Barbie.
I know Mattel got Creative Playthings.
Dang, dog.
Mattel absolutely got Corgi. So yeah. So the US is absolutely, they have completely usurped the Germans in terms of making cheap toys until World War II. What won't the World Wars mess up, you say?
Oh dear.
As you're probably aware, World War II, pretty much all production of anything that wasn't supplies for the military were stopped. So tin toys obviously took a hit and they stopped being made in the US entirely. But after World War II, the U.S. uses its occupation of Japan to, in their own words, make them produce high-labor, low-value goods.
Well.
And this is a cruel and horrible piece of history, but, we're gonna do this twice. It worked a little too well. They gave Japan the industry and technology to do this, and after Japan regained its independence, they would continue to dominate the market until tin stopped being a material.
Whoops.
So good job, the U.S. You played yourself. In the 1960s, late 1960s, early 1970s, the introduction of cheap and stable plastics ends the popularity and need for tin toys entirely.
The end.
And so that's what they're like. What's your favorite thing about tin toys, Ken?
Oh gosh, how do I pick just one?
Are you actually really not familiar with like them at all?
I'm familiar with the Tin Soldier.
The Tin Soldier is actually a great example. I probably have a separate episode just to talk about toy soldiers.
But today, tin soldiers.
Well, yeah, the tin soldier is just a symptom of the toy soldier. It's one of the oldest toys, like, you know, in written history, so. You're probably familiar with tin cars if you search your memories a little harder.
Am I?
You're not familiar with tin cars? Wow.
I don't play with a whole lot of tin, my
okay,
dude.
Right. So cars were really, really popular for tin. And actually, there's an entire subcategory of tin toys called transport toys, which covers the whole gamut of what you may assume.
Including trains.
Including trains. You are correct, sir.
Okay, now I'm back on board. Choo-choo, motherfuckers. Let's go.
Yeah, actually, tin toys made toy trains really popular because, like everything else, it made them a lot cheaper and accessible. Before, a toy train was an absolute luxury. Now a toy train was a lower-middle-class luxury. A lot of people are familiar with, I think, really specifically the atomic era toys. So you're talking like 1950s. You start getting things like little laser guns. I know for a fact there is a copy of the Apollo space capsule that was made. And just robots, so many robots. I guess you can kind of get how I got into this.
Because of the transforming robots?
Because of the transforming robots that were directly influenced by the tin robots. This is like the preponderance of what it's called retrofuturism now, right?
Yeah.
Retrofuturism, I think, is the leading cause of people giving a shit about tin toys. It's because when you see them, they are nutso bonkers, and it is a really charming look into retrofuturism and, you know, the mindset that created these, like, artifacts. Because there's something about seeing a little Apollo space capsule that spins and, like, actually spits little sparks that makes you go, like, oh, people used to have hope.
Wow.
Sorry, was that too dark?
Little bit, my dude.
Well, there's also kind of the same reason Steiff got popular. Really popular German lines of wind-up animals, which are just charming all the time. And then, of course, there's the crossovers of all these other collectibles where if you're into cars, tin cars will obviously really appeal to you. And there's a lot. And, you know, it's any special interest you have, planes, boats, zeppelins, any outmoded form of transportation you can think of. The breadth and charm of them really, really speaks to people. One of my favorite things about them is actually that this is one of those unusual examples where some of the newer ones are worth more than the older ones.
Oh.
The Japanese makes, specifically through the 50s and 60s, mostly for the reasons I was talking about, where they tend to be incredibly high quality, the prints are complex and highly realistic, and they reflect an interest in developing technology. And robots are just really cool. So the Japanese toys from then are like the best of the best, so they are really desirable. They're not always expensive, because they also got made the fastest and the most often. But you actually do get a lot of specific ones, because some toys only ever made it to the US, and some toys only ever got distributed to Japan and China and some other more reachable countries and so on and so forth. So you actually do have some scarcity there, which makes it a really exciting area to collect. There's a balance of availability.
Okay.
Other than that, the older examples, like anything, tend to also reach up into those numbers where you're looking at thousands, just because they're old. People really seem to like the racist ones and the ones about clowns.
I mean, I'm here for clowns, I guess.
The clowns are very fun. The clowns actually have some, like, really interesting mechanisms. You know, they've got, like, the little tabs that make them do flips. You get clowns on little donkeys that get, like, thrown off the donkey and then put back on. These little, like, miniature perpetual motion devices that just shoot balls up to the top of something so it rolls down.
Uh-huh.
Pretty sure there's Mickey Mouse riding a motorcycle at some point. I mean, really, the variety is truly breathtaking. And the colors are so vibrant, and, like, even if you never played with tin toys, I think they take you right back to, like, childhood. It's like a collective unconscious memory of childhood. I don't know. Is that too high concept for a Ding Dong podcast?
I don't think it's particularly high concept. I'm just not sure there is such a thing as a collective universal childhood.
You know what? Go off. We're going to give you a list of links. You go off and yell at us about whether or not you believe in that. A lot of things that are really cool are the level of technologies that are available. Almost everything in history, a lot sooner than you thought they would be. You already had, you know how friction toys work, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, those were from the 1890s. And it's exciting that a lot of these basic clockworks are really a lot older than you think. Because people just tend to assume when it's mechanical that it was newer. But you're wrong. How's that feel? How's that feel to be wrong?
You're wrong. And we started this podcast specifically to tell you that you are incorrect.
Yeah, Ken vetoed the name You're Wrong for the podcast. Because he was like, no, because then they won't listen to it and find out that they're wrong. A lot of other things that cover desirability other than subject matter, which can be very subjective when you talk about the absolute number of toys that are available.
Subject matter is subjective?
No, the value of the subject matter is subjective.
Subjective subject matter.
Our quality, of course, Natch, and packaging. A lot of people get into toys just because the perfect toy is incredibly elusive. Toys being made to be played with by a subset of human beings that are not known for their care.
Oh, you mean a toy in perfect condition?
In perfect condition, yeah. Not a child in perfect condition. Is that what it sounded like?
Not like the ideal toy that fulfills all children's needs universally.
No, I was talking about a toy in good condition.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Now that's high concept.
Got a little high concept there. Yeah, the appeal for a lot of collectors is kind of that exclusiveness. where most of the toys you find are going to be pretty beat up because they're toys. But there is something magical about seeing one with the original box.
Magic.
In part because it lends an air of, it's a kind of, what's the word I'm thinking of? Provenance.
Provenance?
Boxes are a part of provenance.
You heard it here first. We're the only one saying that.
It's us. I've got a patent pending.
Trademark.
I think the French are going to give me a bit of a fight, but hey. In terms of condition, you're also looking at pretty much two axes, which is whether or not it works, if it's a moving toy, and it usually is. And whether or not it looks good still, which is how much of the lithography or paint is still attached to it. Is it rusted? Has the rust eaten away? Is it cleanable rust? That kind of thing.
Okay.
I think this has got a lot to do with the anticipation, because finding a tin toy and finding out if it works is almost intoxicating. It's an exciting moment. And I'm sorry you haven't experienced it.
It's a grand and intoxicating innocence?
It's a grand and intoxicating innocence. You are correct, my friend.
Beautiful.
You can't kill a tin toy.
The tin soldier would disagree.
Oh, yikes. Big yikes, my friend.
Hans Christian Andersen was working through some shit.
Yeah. He had some problems, huh?
He was working through some feelings. He had a lot of big feelings.
That he projected onto little tiny people.
Yay!
So, while we were talking earlier about the pretty interesting number of toy companies that actually still survive from this period, we run into a problem with tin toys. And anything mass-produced, really, but we're talking about reproductions, of course.
Oh, we've produced it once on a mass scale, we can produce it again on the same mass scale.
Exactly, and the simplicity of them makes that even more attractive. And a lot of the companies that made them are still functioning, which means they actually still have the original dies.
Oh.
Actually, I know that there is one particular villain in this arena, which is the toy company Shiling, I believe is based out of China at the moment, but they are actually using a bunch of old die cuts that they purchased or owned to just wholesale reproduce them for fun.
Yay!
A good thing about these are marked Shiling, so you should be, don't buy those.
Unless you just want to have a cool tin toy.
Unless you want to have a cool tin toy, in which case that's a really cheap option. They make a lot of the really old ones, and you can get them for $10. And they are pretty good in terms of accuracy. They're pretty faithful. But I have some handy tips, some tricks to put in your toolbox to let you spot the real ones from the fakes.
Woo.
This is a subject that if you've ever met me in person, or actually, I guess, listen to this podcast a lot, I'm going to talk about print quality and how you can use that to determine age.
Cool.
If you get a chance to get proficient in just telling different printing methods apart, I recommend it. It'll help. In this case, when you talk about modern tin toys, you're actually talking 1970s and above. And a lot of people are pretty good at spotting things that are printed now-ish and the way dot matrix and laser printers leave ink on pages, right?
Yes.
Not that different in the 1970s. The 1970s, it's still a plate process, but they're using a really similar concept, which is four basic color plates that they use to make tiny dots that intermix, just like a printer.
Like on old comics.
Yeah, exactly. So you look at non-single color patches on the toy, and if it looks like it was printed like a comic, that's your clue that it's a reproduction of some sort. All of the earlier lithography was done with lots and lots of plates, I think up to 12, sometimes 24, if you're real fancy, and all of the pieces should be solid fields overlaid on each other. Like a screen print, if you're familiar with what that looks like.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty reliable. I think the trick is just to look for areas where there's shading or colors crossing into each other, because even when you're using a dot comic type printing, if it's one color, you're gonna have a solid field. It's gonna be harder to tell. But most of them have that, so you're in luck. Other things you can look at is the construction. This is true of most antiques, I find, the older I get. It's Phillips screws just are new. No one had them in the past. If you see a Phillips screw, just give up.
I do every day.
On what? Anything, I guess. dealer's choice. So what you're looking for is no Phillips screws, generally square nuts, if there is any at all. Trick to older pieces, anything pre-1960, is that they're usually made with solid construction, no rolling, square corners, and a slot and tab system. So you're looking at the tabs actually do tend to be half moon shaped too. So that's an easy visual cue. Even if a piece is broken and is missing a part, you can still see where the slots or the tabs were and kind of differentiate it that way. in general, a lot of quality issues. Obviously, reproductions aren't getting quality checked the way things used to. So mismatched seams can also be a tell. I would combine that with other tells because, you know, anything mass-produced has a tendency to go off kilter, but in general, mismatched seams should clue you in to maybe take a look at the slots, the tabs. Were there Phillips head screws? Should you give up? Another thing is newer toys have rolled seams. This is like for strengthening reasons, but it's just not something you saw pre-1960.
I thought it was for not chopping tiny fingers reasons.
That's dumb. And we don't need to worry about that. And if you're super, you know, if you've checked all of these things and you're still not 100% convinced, bust out a blacklight.
Just for fun at parties.
Just do it. And then you'll be like, oh man, you've got cat hair everywhere, my man. Least popular person in the room, guaranteed. No, red and white and other inks made in 1970 and onward fluoresce in blacklight.
Oh.
Yeah, the pigments from before then almost never do. And before 1940, definitely never do. So sometimes between 1940 and 1960, you can get, like, light fluorescence, but once you, like, kind of side-by-side it, and there are YouTube videos of it, you can get the difference pretty easily.
All right.
And that will help you determine real tin toys. I think that they're really fun. That seems like a silly thing to say about toys, but whatever, I said it, I'll stand by that statement.
I'll chime in, too. Tin toys are fun.
Thank you. See, does it feel good to say that?
We're going to take a strong, unified stance here at Antiques Freaks. Tin toys are fun.
You know, it might be controversial, but I stand by it. Tin toys are fun. They, like a lot of other mass-produced things, you get a huge range of prices, too. These aren't necessarily expensive. I've seen really cool and cute and fun ones for, like, $10 through $30.
That's not bad.
And of course, on the upper end, you do get the tens of thousands of blah, blah, blah. But since tons of them were made, there's a range. And whatever your budget is, you could probably find something to fit it. Which only makes them more fun. Which strengthens our stance here at Antiques Freaks that tin toys are fun. I want the Apollo capsule one so bad.
I know. It would go so great with your Challenger pin.
I really would, yeah. And that is tin toys.
Tin toys. Sauce?
Oh, yes. Sauces include duck sauce. The God, that was a really bad joke, and I'm sorry formally for it.
Eel sauce.
Oh, you're just going to join me on there. Soy sauce.
Sweet and sour sauce.
TheAntiquesAlmanac.com. Mint in Box Collecting Toys. Collectors Weekly. Tin Toys. RealOrRepro.com. New Tin Toys. Copy Vintage Originals. TexasAntiqueMall.com. Tin Litho Fake Real... Great title. And actually, if you're serious about it, just for fun, I recommend RetroWaste.com. They have an exhaustive list of vintage toy makers and actually what became of the companies and through what years. And they have all kinds of toys and a lot of interesting articles on toys.
Extremely
cool.
So
check that out.
If you know where eel sauce is available for consumer purchase, please email AntiquesFreaksPodcast@gmail.com.
I could tell you that right now.
Where is it?
The market in Fall River.
Oh my god, we're going.
Yeah, sure. I can take you there.
For years I have quested in vain.
Why didn't you say something?
I say something every time I'm in a goddamn grocery store and not seeing eel sauce.
Oh my god, have I just been silently absorbing that and been like, oh, you gotta tell them about that later and then forgetting?
If you have something you've been meaning to tell us but keep forgetting... You can join us on Facebook in our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends.
If you like the sounds that came into your ears today, you could scroll on down to wherever you're listening to this and give us a rating of some sort. Any rating will do, and we accept them all. We don't like them all, but we accept them all.
We don't have to like them. They just have to exist.
They just have to be there.
We also have a Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks where you can listen to deleted scenes and help support the show.
Which makes us love you.
I mean, we love you anyway.
We love you anyway, but you know what? It gives it a certain je ne sais quoi.
I will say quoi. It is money.
Well, you know, it's vulgar to say that.
Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes.
And just helping us through.
And thank you in particular for listening.
Especially you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.